This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Second down and four at the Tennessee 7-yard line. One back, Amon Green. Rosenfels gets the snap. Stands in the pocket. Throws over the middle. Hits David Anderson for a touchdown.
I don't know if he did the celebration, the little string dance after that. But that was a touchdown that David Anderson scored. The immortal connection, Rosenfels to Anderson. And he joins us right now on the hotline here on Payne and Pendergast. Former Texans wide receiver, David Anderson. D.A., what's happening? Good morning.
The immortal connection. I think there was at least 1.2 touchdowns.
Between Anderson and Rosenfels.
We averaged no less than 0.3 points a game. You're killing it.
Expected points killing added. It. Yeah. So what's the deal, man? Are your boys going to finally come through and win a World Series
I was just wondering, like, what do you guys do in Houston? Like, every week I just have to watch all this championship sports. My wife is just like, oh, more champions. It's just Los Angeles Lakers and
Talking about basketball. Nobody even watched that.
There's right now.
People are vaguely aware that there was even a championship game played this year, but nobody had any room in their space on their busy schedules of watching football and baseball.
Hey, we know the reason you're able to say everyone pretends to like the DIY beers because you used to bring that all the time into the Texan facility. No one liked your DIY beer. That was terrible.
DIY beer. Oh, my ad. Okay. What the hell are you talking about? I recorded that thing like 9 months ago.
I was like, that's funny. Everyone does pretend to like everyone's DIY beer.
That's true. So DA, you, as you allude to, there are not as many championship level sporting events going on here in Houston, but there is plenty of news going on here in the city. There's tons of news, and I know that you watch from afar. And I know that you've watched the Texans, unravel this year and hopefully eventually put this thing back together again. In your mind, what's the best type of coach for the Houston Texans moving forward?
That's a good question. I really want to better understand what they did to their entire draft class. Obviously, they traded a lot of guys away. I don't know what they have the next 3 years. The 1A, though, is they have a quarterback that they've committed to and that is committed to them, and I think that's the most important. Whenever you talk about coaches taking a job, they want to go where there's a great quarterback. So they have that, right? That was an issue for a while for Houston Texans. And so I think it's an attractive place to go. For when I was there, we were getting over that hump as somewhere we didn't know if we can really get top talent free agent-wise and or coaching-wise, but I don't think that's an issue. It does have a little bit of a, ex-girlfriend feel to it right now, where, you know, the Texans are like never could really get over the hump, never could really, win a championship. They've been flirting with, being a good team for a long time, and they never really gotten over that. So it's going to take a coach that can really come in there and do that. I would like a more veteran coach. I would like probably... I think someone maybe more within I prefer offense more than defense right now, but you don't know. The Texans, when I was there, we were great on offense, terrible on defense. And when I left, they were great on defense, terrible on offense. Right now, they're about mediocre on both. So I don't think you can go wrong with a good defense or offense coach. I think you're taking the best coach that can honestly put together the best staff. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point about the retread. Like, the retreads always get a bad rap, but Andy Reid is the ultimate retread, and that's
ultimate.
Worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
But if I guess the question is always just, okay, which retread is out there at any given moment? And none of the candidates right now. I'm glad you brought that up, because Sean, I can't even think of like a retread type guy or maybe an imminent hot seat departure that would be appealing to me right now.
It feels like it's all coordinators that are in the mix for this thing right now.
Yeah,
yeah.
What's been the rumors?
Eric Bieniemy you dabble in the occasional.
I know Bieniemy well. I played against. Yeah, I didn't play against him, but he was a Colorado guy. I was a Colorado State guy. We ran into him quite a lot.
Okay, what do you know about him?
Former running back for University of Colorado, definitely cut his teeth for a long time being a position coach and then slowly climbing up the ladder to offensive coordinator. He was co-offensive coordinator for a couple years. I remember I got to know Mike Frazier at the Kansas City Chiefs, who's their head analyst, so the guy in the booth talking to Andy Reid throughout the game. And I was like, so how much does Andy Reid kind of talk to Bieniemy? And he said, tons. Like, basically, Bieniemy gives him two plays, sometimes just calls a play. So it kind of reminds me of Kyle Kubiak, where it was like, can Kyle, call his own game? And the answer is yes. He just had to choose, you know, a lot of times are two good plays and Kubiak would choose between them. It's never like, oh, are we going to run the ball short or throw the ball long? It's more like, do you like this outside run or this outside run? So I think he's ready. The thing that I always struggle with as a brand new head coach that's also calling plays, that feels really hard for me. That to me sends alarms to the coach that can't get the timeouts right, the coach that can't get the situations right, and just screws it all up. And I've been making fun of all my Denver fans because they just refuse to acknowledge that Vic over there can't get situations and timeouts right.
It's bad.
How do you look at Deshaun Watson right now? And maybe, what could a new coach bring to the table that he hasn't been exposed to, or maybe what facet of his game could he unleash or discover?
I feel like, you know, he has, like, he's in between. He's not Patrick Mahomes, and that he's not this, like, blessed passer, like 100, like, you know, the, like a Brett Favre type passer. And he's not Mike Vick in that he's, like, so explosive every time he wants to take off. He's right in between. Now, those are two amazing players to be in between, mind you. But he could do a little bit of both of that. So it's about a coach finding the right rhythm to get him into. I always feel like he's out of rhythm. And, like, that's – you just don't want to be, you know, third and seven, third and five. Those key plays that don't seem like hard downs and distances to the average fan – he just seems out of rhythm, and it's a five-step drop. He gets to the top of his drop, and then he's trying to make something happen. And yes, he can scramble and get it every now and then, but those are the plays that you watch that you know that you're truly in rhythm. Is it when you're not scared about a third and five, six, or seven, right? Third, eight, nine, or ten, you got to make a play. Third and five and less, like, you know, you could call pretty much any play in the playbook. But it's those in-between downs and distances when you can really tell a quarterback's rhythm, where he hits five, boom, drops back, throws a little over route, 10-yard gain, okay, move on to the next down and distance. And you just don't really get a lot of that out of this offense.
Yeah, and I guess I struggle sometimes in trying to figure out, okay, how much of that was Bill O'Brien or Tim Kelly's fault versus how much of it is Deshaun Watson and maybe just being a little too greedy on the early downs, where sometimes a veteran quarterback understands that, wow, on second and 10, that 5-yard gain on a nice little crosser to somebody who's otherwise covered turns into third and three, and that's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of that. I don't know. Is it me, or did Bill O'Brien not seem to, like, instill confidence in his players? Like, it just seems like a lot of those. I mean, we're hearing a lot of. I'm all the way out here in Los Angeles. I'm hearing a lot of grumblings about guys that just did not like the way that he kind of. I don't want to just say coached, but let's just say spoke to the players. I've heard a lot of stories about, you know, going all the way back to good old Brock Osweiler about what was going on in there. Then you got Hopkins, and now you got JJ, and now, you know, nothing has come out with Deshaun and whatnot. But, like, that's an issue. When you're talking about your quarterback, your best receiver, your best defensive player, you're not able to communicate with your best players. Like, I've never seen anything like that. Sometimes I see – a coach not able to communicate with a third receiver or like a random special teams player because they're hot-headed, but not your best players. Well, you got to be able to communicate with those guys.
DA, take it a step further, and if he had trouble communicating with some of his key players, he was also given the duties of general manager. So the ones that he just got tired of communicating with or didn't vibe with, he would just trade them, and they were good players.
For nothing.
For nothing.
Which is not a good tactic. You know what I mean? It's like, there's not a lot of long-term success there.
No.
I mean, we've said this like time and time and time again, and I feel like it's weird that fans say it and people from the Bill Belichick tree don't realize it. You see it constantly that you can't be Bill Belichick right off the bat, right? Everyone's like, oh, you know, I come from his tree. I'm going to coach like him. You can't. What also they don't see, and this is my opinion, and I know a little bit. I have like two sources I could quote for this, but what he does is he communicates to his Bill Belichick. This being Bill Belichick, mm-hmm. communicates to his coaches in one way in meetings, and I'm sure talks about players a certain way, and also addresses a team in a certain way, and that's one way. But what people don't realize is Bill Belichick makes these micro relationships with all of these players that allows him to get intel on other teams because he's like. A prime example is my buddy Will Svitek, a random left tackle, bounced around the league five times. He said Bill Belichick would talk to him probably every other week, just kind of pull him aside, ask him some questions about other guys on other teams that he had been around. And then Will's dad passed away, and Bill Belichick, like, after practice, spoke to him for like an hour and a half and, like, had this relationship with Will, a random guy on the roster. And it was only there for one season, but Bill was able to get what he wanted out of him, which is a lot of intel on free agents and people from other teams. And Will got what he wanted, which is a chance to play for the Patriots and win a championship. And so, like, it was this, he establishes these relationships, micro or not, that the players respect. And that's the way he moves forward. You don't see that, and you didn't see that in Houston with Bill O'Brien. It was just like it seemed like there was fire and ice everywhere he went. It was just he was really polarizing with the relationships he was building on the team.
Hey, Dave, Sean and I were
When GM is where do I put in the application? You guys accepting them on the radio?
That would be gm@HoustonTexans.com. You send it right
there.
Okay, cool. How do you feel?
HoustonTexans.gm?
Well, this is the thing. How do you feel about working for televangelists / motivational speakers / aspiring authors? Because that's who's running the show here is our dynamic Jack Easterby.
Joel Osteen's kind of.
Hey,
let's
I wanted to ask
I
you
very good in Tim Tebow's huddle.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, you were working with the XFL a little bit, doing some advanced stat work with your company. Do you have any clue yet whether you're going to be working with The Rock or what's going to happen with the XFL?
So I'm pretty sure The Rock threw in a lowball bid and didn't think he was going to get it, and he did. But that's what it seems like. He's like,
I've got a league.
I just wanted to put something on my Instagram.
He's like, oh, shoot. So how much more money is this going to cost me? I think they're trying to get it together right now. I haven't heard anything in terms of, you know, the first hire you're going to hear of is a commissioner or president of the XFL or something like that. So they haven't made any of those announcements. You really haven't heard anything in terms of are they going to have the same strategy and team rollout, like are the same locations? How are they owe me a good chunk of change. So I wouldn't mind if working for The Rock again, but he just, you know, he's got some, I think I'm one of those bills at like a house you never go to, you know, he has like five houses and there's like the random bill from a parking ticket from 6 years ago. You're like, I don't even have that car anymore. I'm not paying.
How's that work? So you make like, you know, your spot in line in terms of creditors and where you line up and then you just wait until like maybe you need to sue somebody or something.
You can, but the problem is then so bankruptcy doesn't leave all of your debt, especially if you sell if they sold it, right? So they sold it. So technically they're supposed to pick up and the majority of the debt and restructure it. So they're supposed to come out. They'll start at the top with coaches and the facilities that they rented for millions of dollars, and then they'll make their way down to us. But yeah, sometimes they just don't get all the way down there. They're like, okay, you can sue me for the whatever $50,000 US. I'll just put you in $100,000 in legal fees.
And you're like, that's going to be your. You'll be lying on your deathbed, and finally, finally, like on your last dying gasp. Yeah, it'll come, and you'll raise your hand in victory and say, "I won! I won!"
I got that Whataburger gift card from The Rock.
That's it. That's former Texans wide receiver David Anderson. D.A., you are always good radio, my friend, even if you just came in and immediately reminded us that we don't have any championship-level sports action going on right now.
You know what? It's. I saw your tweet about Daryl Morey leaving the facility. That had to be the weirdest thing I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, that was Berman.
What's Mark doing?
He's doing what he always does. He's creeping on people.
Some Bermuda shorts and a suit top or something. Yes. What's Berman doing these days?
He's doing what he did. He was filming that video of Daryl Morey walking out of the facility.
Yeah, you know what, Berman? You know what he'll be doing? He, on your deathbed, when you get that check, Berman's going to be the one documenting
it. He will.
He'll be there with a camera crew.
Hey, how does this feel? How does this feel?
Justice. We all know Richard Justice.
It will be Richard Justice.
It will be
Richard Justice.
And Richard Justice will be writing about this mediocre third down receiver. I'm like, come on, I'm dead, man. I'm dead.
Oh, I'm DA, dead. We appreciate the time as always. We will do this again very, very soon. Thank you.
Absolutely, guys. Have a good one.
Take care. That's David Anderson, former Texans wide receiver. All right, we went over. We got to get back on the clock here. As we do, we will ask the question in the next segment. The Cowboys got blown out by the Cardinals last night. They're 2-4. Their quarterback's hurt, but they are leading their division. Would you rather be a Texan fan or a Cowboy fan right now? That's next.
Murray is under center. Stop the snap. Spins. Hands off to Draco. Oh, big hole. 35-40. Inside the numbers, 50. Chase to the 40. On the numbers, the 30. To the 20. To the 10. To the 5. It's a touchdown. Untouched. Galloping downfield. 69 yards.
That was Kenyon Drake for the Arizona Cardinals last night against the Dallas Cowboys. The Cowboys got worked by the Cardinals. That was Westwood One, Kevin Harlan on the call. And Seth, the Cowboys are the first team to lead their division with a sub-500 record after 6 weeks since the merger in 1970. It's never happened before where 6 weeks into a season, a team has been sub-500 and leading their division. That division was going to be bad. Part of the reason I picked the Cowboys to make a deep run this year in the playoffs was because I thought they'd have a really good record, in large part because they'd get to play the Giants, the Redskins, and the Eagles twice apiece. So I thought the Cowboys could be a 12-4 football team very easily this year. They were 8-8 last year and probably should have been better than 8-8. They lost a few kind of coin flipper games that you know, the statistics tell you those things tend to even out. It turns out, yeah, they may win their division, but they're just as bad as these other teams right now. They're 2-4, and their defense is atrocious. It is really, really bad.
If you're feeling bad about the Texans, just know that the Cowboys are that much worse, and there's almost nothing redeeming about their defense, especially when you consider that they've been playing against some of those NFC East opponents. So as bad as the Texans' defense has been, it's been versus a pretty damn tough schedule for the most part. The Cowboys have not had as difficult a schedule, and they just are abysmal.
They're abysmal.
I would say the couple bright spots, I would say, is Aldon Smith, I think, like after being out of the league for it seems like a damn near a decade.
He was just
an absolute mess. That's like one of the bright things I can think of on that defense right now. But beyond that, it's all just a bunch of just flotsam and jetsam.
It is
very, very bad. Bad showing. Frankly, Dallas, bad look for the state of Texas. And if I'm Dak Prescott, I'm starting to wonder, is Dak Prescott holding out because he's not getting the right contract? Or does Dak Prescott just want out of Dallas? And, you know, when I hear my owner say, like, well, you know, you should appreciate how much money you can make in endorsements here, so we shouldn't have to pay you. That makes me want to say, well, go screw yourself. Mm-hmm. I'll go find someplace else to play.
Would you rather be a fan of the Texans or the Cowboys right now for this season? Just for this season, would you rather be a fan of the Cowboys? Because the Cowboys are still, even at 2-4, they're favored to win the division. The Texans, you're essentially getting to watch the Deshaun Watson show every week and probably finish 6-10 at the end.
Now, by the odds, are they actually favored to win the division?
They are, yes.
They are.
Even with Andy Dalton at quarterback.
And with that defense.
Well, let me backtrack. the new odds for the division come out this week. But going into this week, knowing Andy Dalton was their quarterback, they were minus 125 to win the division. They're still leading the division at 2-4. But to your point, I guess, do you feel as good about them now after watching this thing against the Cardinals and watch Andy Dalton doing Andy Dalton things? Maybe not. The bottom line is, Seth, still, who would you take over them in the division? Well, the Eagles, the Redskins, or the Giants?
Right. But as far as your question, who would you prefer, the Texans or the Cowboys? And I think I can say this. I can step out of my own skin and look at this objectively. I think that the Texans by far, because as any Cowboys fan would tell you, there's a certain level of uncertainty around Dak Prescott. I don't honestly think he's going to be gone, but he's also not under contract. And it's going to be harder and harder to fill the roster around a guy who's getting an increasingly large franchise tag figure every year, which he will next year. And you don't know, even though this seems to be a relatively predictable recovery for Dak Prescott, and people are projecting 4 to 5 months before a full return to activity, it's still a pretty damn scary injury. And whenever you have to put pins into the ankle, you never quite know if he's going to be the same when he comes back. So there's a whole lot of uncertainty around Dak Prescott. But then the biggest problem you have with the Packers is that you just hired Mike McCarthy. Like, Mike McCarthy, who had lost all institutional control in Green Bay, and who has since proven that he's the issue, and that Aaron Rodgers is a much better quarterback now with a new coach than with Mike McCarthy. That's the guy that you've got in charge right now. The guy who openly admitted to lying at the press conference about watching all the film from the previous season. All of that is just a mess up there. Yes, you would definitely choose the Texans, who don't have a head coach at this point. So there's a chance that at the very least you're going to feel better about him than Mike McCarthy. And then you have Deshaun Watson fully healthy and under contract.
Yeah, you get 10 games of seeing if Deshaun can still put up big numbers. They win a few games along the way. It's not what you drew up on the board before the season. To me, you touched on it, Seth. The big game changer is the fact that the Texans wisely have opened up their head coach and general manager spots, which puts a cloud of hope over everything that you're watching. I mean, can you imagine if they lose that game to the Titans this past week, fall to 1-5, and we're sitting through Bill O'Brien press conferences again this week? Can you even imagine that right now? I mean, that would be absolutely miserable. So, the head coaching change, especially happening as early as it did in the season, it does change the complexion of your optimism, emotion. I don't know what the word is I'm looking for. You know, happiness. Watching the happiness is probably too strong a word. But it at least makes it a more pleasurable experience to be a fan of that team for the next 10 weeks or 11 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if Dak Prescott, I don't know. I guess I'm just thinking about free agents looking at the team too. Like, I don't know. I'd have to talk to some players about this. I haven't talked to anybody about this in a while. But I don't get the sense that players really look at the Cowboys as anything special anymore. Where it used to mean something. Like, I remember when I was a young kid, I hated the Cowboys, but at the same time, I can remember the first time I stepped into Texas Stadium and saw all those names on the Ring of Honor and everything, and it was kind of freaky. Like, it was holy crap, these are the Dallas Cowboys. I don't know why any 22-year-old these days would look at the Cowboys as anything exceptional.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, they've been a playoff team a few times over the last decade, but they've just been an average team overall. I still think the brand carries a big deal. If you follow the league, you know how Jerry Jones is a big figure in the league. I still think it means something. Look, Seth, I should be able to assess this as well as anybody because I went to the Dallas Cowboys of football universities. Notre Dame, which, you know, back there was a time and place where they were the Dallas Cowboys of college football, and now they're kind of the Dallas Cowboys of college football. You know what I mean? You know, they make the college football playoff once every 7 years, and they win 10 games on occasion.
It's a curiosity to the younger generation.
Yes.
Like, yeah, I understand that players understand, you know, you see it, you go to a sports bar and you can see how many Cowboys fans there are, but it's still a curiosity. The Cowboys haven't been to a conference championship game since, I believe, 1995.
I think you're right.
So there's no living NFL rookie, or even now, even the guys who are first-time free agents, can even remember a time when the Cowboys were actually relevant as a football team. And I think sometimes Cowboys fans forget that and don't realize it. When it comes to even just evaluating, okay, Texans versus the Cowboys, a young man today has no reason to really feel that there's a difference between those two. I'm not, yes, I fully recognize the Texans haven't made it to a conference championship game, but all I'm saying is that doesn't make them any different than the Dallas Cowboys in the eyes of a 20-year-old.
Download the radio.com app. Use that radio.com rewind feature. We keep getting texts from people. It's really funny. We get texts from people about a topic we talked about 45 minutes ago, and it gets confusing. And then Seth and I are like, oh, that's right. They use the radio.com rewind feature. It's a cool feature, and we appreciate you downloading the app and using it. Vanessa Richardson from Channel 2 joined us earlier on the show, caught up with Jeff Luhnow, did a sit-down interview with Jeff Luhnow on Channel 2 that ran last night, that's up on their website at click2houston.com. Jeff Luhnow talked about the handling of the Brandon Taubman incident, and also, what is he looking at for his next chapter? I think this will intrigue a lot of Houston sports fans. That's next.
The Dodgers and other clubs, but I know the Dodgers for sure, were adamant about some big punishments. Mm-hmm. And they wanted the manager and they wanted the general manager to go down in this scandal. And they got it. And I think the investigation was not attempting to really uncover who did what and who was responsible. It was, the goal of the investigation was to deliver punishments that Rob could feel good about and that would calm the panic that all the other teams, I mean, there was a drumbeat for punishments.
That's Jeff Luhnow, former Astros general manager, in about 37-minute sit-down with Vanessa Richardson from Channel 2 here in town, KPRC. She joined us earlier in the show and kind of took us through how the whole interview came about. Good for her. It was something she had been working on for a while with the Luhnows, to do that sit-down interview with Jeff Luhnow, and a chance for him to give his side of the story, which the prevailing theme relative to the trash can banging scandal, Seth, is he continues to maintain, Luhnow does, that he knew nothing about that, and that the punishment for him was not justified. And he revealed that he made an appointment to fly to New York to see Rob Manfred. He did just that. He brought a 150-page binder with him with 14 tabs, thousands of shreds of evidence of electronic communication, texts and emails and things like that, to try to essentially tell his side of the story. At the end of the day, Rob Manfred, according to Luhnow right there, had enough ball clubs that wanted a pound of flesh from this whole thing, where A.J. Hinch and Luhnow suspended, and then Jim Crane, which I think some people get twisted sometimes. Jim Crane chose to fire those two. The decision of baseball was to suspend Hinch and Luhnow for a year, and then subsequently Jim Crane, just within minutes after that, decided to fire both of them.
I'm glad you brought up that 150-page binder, because it reminded me of Scott Boras and his notoriously large binders about how good people, you know, how good his clients
are.
I gotta just throw this advice out to anybody. If you present anybody with a 150-page binder, that is a binder that is not going to get read. Like, I don't understand what people think are going to happen with these tomes that they write. No, you got to boil it all down to, like, three salient points, your three best arguments, and there you have it. And I think in this interview, I think that he did an actually pretty good job of laying out his arguments. I think, though, and it's a great, you should go check it out online
Click2Houston.com.
Because she did a great job with the interview. It's 37 minutes long. I watched it in its entirety at 4 o'clock this morning. And I think he did a good job addressing each of the items that had come up in terms of whose fault was what. Him claiming that Major League Baseball doesn't have any actual smoking gun evidence, which I think is true. I agree with that. The most damning thing Major League Baseball has are some emails where the sign stealing is mentioned, but it's not clear from Jeff Luhnow's responses to those emails that he ever actually read the emails. You know, at one point he says that the email that he had responded to that included something about this, about the trash can banging, it basically was sent 15 seconds after he had sent another email. So he was admitting to being a bad manager and, like, actually replying to an email that he didn't actually read. But it's feasible that he didn't actually read that. I think that he made good cases there. So on each one of these steps along the way, he'll make a good argument for why he didn't know or he wasn't responsible. And yet I left the interview feeling like, boy, he's still not really taking responsibility for all of this happening on his watch. Even though he said that, I never felt like that he really believes that, hey, maybe I created this institution where people were so hungry and desperate to find any little edge that I should have done a better job of steering the entire ship and having institutional control over it.
Yeah, taking accountability, I think, still might be an issue. Getting his side of the story out, he did, as you mentioned, Seth, in great detail. Here is Jeff Luhnow with an answer that I think kind of supports what you're talking about, Seth, of not him fully taking responsibility for overseeing an organization that partook in what the Astros were doing. Here is Jeff Luhnow on what his biggest regret is.
Undoubtedly, the fact that the success has been stained by what happened in 2017 and 18 to a certain extent. This team was so good. I mean, Vanessa, you got to go back to, you weren't here. We were terrible. 2011, 2012, 2013, it was the worst team in baseball, and it wasn't even close. And we didn't have a very good farm system either. We turned it around completely. By 2015, we made the playoffs. Think about it. 2015, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, five playoffs in 6 years, four American League championships in a row, two World Series appearances, one title. That's a run no other team in baseball has been on, that type of run, maybe the Dodgers, but they never got to the same endpoint that we got to. Why we have to soil that with ridiculous cheating executed by people who are, you know, are you know, weren't, they didn't ask for permission. They just did it.
All right. So there you go. That, Seth, that to me, I think is when you go, what's your biggest regret? When you're in the situation Jeff Luhnow's in and your biggest regret isn't something that you did, it's something that you feel happened to you, I think that's a big distinction. And I think Jeff Luhnow feels like the biggest regret is that it happened, not that he was overseeing or maybe could have done something. I know he's going to claim, yeah, I didn't know anything about this. You know, you can always dig harder, I suppose.
You know? Yeah, you know what? It felt a whole lot like the perception of steroids in baseball, where, you know, and obviously that happened with all the teams and all the general managers and owners, but there was always this sense that owners and GMs wanted to be able to, they wanted, plausible deniability. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be able to say, hey, look, players do what they're going to do. I don't know why all the home run numbers are going up so high, which you knew was BS, right? But the difference in baseball, I guess, was that every GM and every owner was involved in that, so it was harder to pick one person out. I think that Luhnow is in that same boat and using that same defense to a certain degree, but he's the only guy that was singled out. I actually, like, if it sounds like I'm being harsh on Luhnow, don't get me wrong, I do feel the Astros were unfairly scapegoated and targeted. Mm-hmm. I do feel that the Astros did what they did because they felt like there was an arms race in baseball and that they had to keep up with it. It's just that, but for whatever reason, because I think Manfred was desperate not to, the integrity of the game would have really been soiled if you found out that, like, oh, the 10 best teams in baseball were doing it and the other 20 teams weren't doing it. Then all of a sudden, an entire era of baseball, if people are starting to turn their nose up at, versus this was, it's very easy to have one villain. Just like you don't have a 144-page binder, you don't have multiple villains. You can never pick out multiple villains. Have one villain? Oh, man, that's an easy story to grasp.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I would say as far as Jeff Luhnow's, maybe not legacy, but the impression people have of Luhnow, I would say it's by and large an unfavorable opinion, and I think it's a two-pronged thing. I think it is the sign-stealing, his distancing himself from the sign stealing. And then I would say the other prong is the Brandon Taubman incident, where, just to refresh, Brandon Taubman, who was assistant GM to Jeff Luhnow back for a few years until he was fired after the ALCS in 2019, fired because during the locker room or the clubhouse celebration after the win over the Yankees in the ALCS, Brandon Taubman went over and flaunted the Roberto Osuna trade in the face of a handful of female reporters, at least one of whom was very outspoken about the trade for Osuna the year before. Osuna, who was in the middle of serving a suspension for domestic violence the year before when they traded for him. And as you pointed out earlier, Seth, doing so in a frat boy, drunken kind of way. You know,
right. It seemed to onlookers like, you know, he might as well be drunk or something.
He was out of control.
Well, yeah, and I think, and then the bigger crime there too was not just – when it's one incident and it's one employee, okay, you can handle that and you can take care of it. The real big flub was the organization putting out a statement that basically called the reporters liars for reporting it as such, when they were very clearly telling the truth.
A statement that Luno became the face of because he was the first Astro employee to go face the music post that statement that tried to discredit and disparage the reporter who put that story out, called the story a fabrication. Luno talked about the experience of going out to talk to the reporters after the organization put that statement out, a statement that Luno claims he did not, after reading it, did not want the organization to put out. They put it out anyways, then sent him out to meet with the media. Here's his recount of that story.
About 20 seconds before I walked into a room filled with baseball reporters who were all looking to attack somebody, I was instructed by one of the people that wrote the response not to disclose who wrote it and to make everybody understand that it was an Astros response, but not to talk about the people who were involved. I followed those instructions. I sat there for 20 minutes and was attacked by every media outlet in the country. And I know I didn't handle it as well as I could have. But I didn't want to lie, so I told them that I had seen the response before it went out, which essentially made me the face of the response because no one else was willing to face the music. When that interview was over, I received a text message from the other person who had been involved in writing it and crafting it, thanking me for taking one for the team.
Okay, so that's Jeff Luno's recount of that. Seth, as we go through both of these pieces of Luno history here, his role or lack thereof, he would claim, in the sign stealing, in the garbage can banging specifically. We need to be specific. The garbage can banging scheme, because Luno does make the distinction several times about tipping of signs, decoding of signs that a catcher has, the legal sign stealing, if you will, versus the trash can. So you have Luno and him distancing himself from the trash can, and Luno and him distancing himself from the statement put out by the organization in the wake of the Brandon Taubman incident. I almost feel like if I'm Luno and I go, I got to cleanse myself of one of these two things to make myself more hireable. And I think he's going to work again, just to be clear, but just to make myself more hireable. I feel like the Taubman one is the one that needs more distancing than the sign stealing. The sign stealing can eventually write off as just baseball being baseball. The Taubman thing, especially in this day and age, that's bad. And especially the disparaging and discrediting of a reporter, a female reporter in the process.
In this part, too, you know, Sean, I told you a couple weeks ago that I'd been having this conversation with an old-school NFL scout. It was a really bright guy, still employed. He's been in the NFL forever. But I was talking about analytics, and what he told me was, you know, I love analytics. I think the problem is I have a hard time figuring out who I can trust and who I can't, and what, like, who am I talking to and who am I giving this information to, when a lot of the guys that you're bringing up in analytics – weren't even raised in like a team sports environment and didn't come up through the hard way. And you just don't feel like, I don't know if I can trust these guys. So when I heard Luno say that, like, he had to be told that it was an organizational thing, that when he went up there to represent the team, like, the fact that he had to either be asked or told that, hey, this is something where you kind of fall on your sword, that's just a given. Like, that's what you do. You go up. It's not like, what was he going to do? Like, call out individuals in the organization that had flubbed it? He's in charge, and he has to go up and say fully the same thing A.J. Hinch did. A.J. Hinch got up and took responsibility for something that somebody in the front office did. Like, something that A.J. Hinch had no responsibility about after that Brandon Taubman incident. Hinch got up, and it was the first time that the organization looked like it had any humanity to it at all. Yeah. And basically calling out his organization. That's the part where guys like Luno make people a little, they give him the cold pricklies a little bit, because you just don't know if you can trust a guy like that. Like, what is this guy, and why does he need to be told that, yeah, in this situation, it's not about self-preservation, it's about making the organization look better.
Well, let's connect the dots. The big loser in that whole thing, if you start to read between the lines, is Jim Crane. I mean, Jim Crane theoretically should be the only one that can tell Jeff Luno what to do in that building when he's the executive vice president and general manager of the baseball team, right? Like, the marketing person, theoretically, I mean, I don't know what the organizational chart looked like, but I'm assuming that the head of PR marketing is not somebody who can give Jeff Luno a direct order to go out and do something that he thinks is wrong, by the way, you know, according to him. You know, that's got to come from on high. That's got to come from somebody above Jeff Luhnow, does it not?
And I think that's where I think with Luhnow and hiring, and like I would say with the Texans or anybody else right now, like analytics is a part of your organization, but you always have to be sure that you counterbalance the analytics with a human touch. I think that's something that Daryl Morey did really well, in that at least partly with the coaches that he worked with between McCall and D'Antoni, I think that they counterbalance some of the analytical side, even though, you know, Morey especially was more analytically, D'Antoni was more analytically inclined. They balanced it out. And that's where, whether you're Cal McNair or Jim Crane or anybody else, when you're hiring, you got to think about that.
I would recommend going to radio.com/picks to participate in the Rocket Mortgage 2020 Pro Football Pick'em Contest. You can win $1,000 a week competing against me and other hosts around the country. Radio.com/picks. Seth, antibodies to you, my friend.
Antibodies and good beneficial press conferences to you.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you very much. He's Seth Payne. I'm Sean Pendergast. He's Ben Gary producing. We thank all of you for listening today. We will be back at 6 a.m. tomorrow. In the Loop is up next. Have a great day, everybody.
All right, football fans, the NFL Draft is almost here, and the free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. AUDACY. Download it today.